Big red yawning skull next to, in the margin, out of impatience. The networks were having problems drawing the kind of audiences they needed to justify the ad rates their huge overheads slavering maw demanded. The Big Four's arch foe was America's 100-plus regional and national cable networks, which, in the premillennial Limbaugh era of extraordinarily generous Justice Department interpretation of the Sherman statutes, had coalesced into a fractious but potent trade association under the stewardship of TCI's Malone, TBS's Turner, and a shadowy Albertan figure who owned the view out the simulated window of various lavish homes and exotic locales channel, the Yuletide Fireplace channel, CBC Cable's educational programming matrix, and four of Le Groupe Vidéotron's five big Canadian shop-at-home networks. Mounting an aggressive Hearts and Minds campaign that derided the passivity of hundreds of millions of viewers, forced to choose nightly between only four statistically pussified network broadcasters, then extolled the empoweringly American choice of 500-plus esoteric cable options, the American Council of Disseminators of Cable was attacking the four right at the ideological root, the psychic matrix where viewers had been conditioned rather deliciously, by the Big Four networks and their advertisers themselves, Hal notes, to associate the freedom to choose and the right to be entertained with all that was U.S. and true. The AC/DC campaign, brilliantly orchestrated by Boston, Massachusetts' Viney and Veals advertising, was pummeling the Big Four in the fiscal thorax with its ubiquitous anti-passivity slogan, "Don't sit still for anything less," when a wholly unintended coup de grace to network viability was delivered in the form of an unrelated Viney and Veals side venture. V&V, like most U.S. ad agencies, greedily buttered its bread on every conceivable side when it could, and started taking advantage of the plummeting Big Four advertising rates to launch effective network ad campaigns for products and services that wouldn't previously have been able to afford national image proliferation. For the obscure local Nunhagen Aspirin Company of Framingham, Massachusetts, Viney and Veals got the Enfield-based National Craniofacial Pain Foundation to sponsor a huge touring exhibition of paintings by artists with crippling craniofacial pain about crippling craniofacial pain. The resultant network Nunhagen ads were simply silent 30-second shots of some of the exhibits with Nunhagen Aspirin in soothing pale pastels at lower left. The paintings themselves were excruciating, the more so because consumer HDTV had arrived, at least in the very upscale Incandenza home. The ads with the more dental pain-type paintings, Hal doesn't even want to think back on, while with a fragment of cannoli wedged someplace upper left he keeps looking around for Shocked to ask him to have a angle-mirrored look at. One he can recall was of an ordinary middle-class American guy's regular face, but with a tornado coming out of the right eye socket and a mouth at the vortex of that tornado screaming. And that was a mild one.
162.
The ads cost next to nothing to produce. Nunhagen Aspirin sales went nationally roofward, even as ratings figures for the Nunhagen ads themselves went from low to abysmal. People found the paintings so excruciating that they were buying the product but recoiling from the ads. Now, you'd think this wouldn't matter so long as the product itself was selling so well. This fact that millions of national viewers were zapping or surfing to a different channel with their remotes the moment a silent, painted, twisted face with a hatchet in its forehead came on. But what made the Nunhagen ads sort of fatally powerful was that they also compromised the ratings figures for the ads that followed them, and for the programs that enclosed the ads. And worse, were disastrous because they were so violently unpleasing to look at that they awakened from their spectatorial slumbers literally millions of network devotees who'd hitherto been so numbed and pacified they usually hadn't bothered to expend the thumb-muscle energy required to zap or surf away from anything on the screen, awakened legions of these suddenly violently repelled and disturbed viewers to the power and agency their thumbs actually afforded them. Viney and Veals' next broadcast, Cash Cow, a lurid series of spots for a national string of walk-in liposuction clinics, reinforced the V&V trend of high product sales but dreadful ad ratings. And here the Big Four were really put on the spot because, even though the critics and PTAs and eating disorder-oriented distaff packs were denouncing the lipovax spots, shots of rippling cellulite and explicit clips of procedures that resemble crosses between hyperbolic Hoover upright demonstrations and filmed autopsies and cholesterol-conscious cooking shows that involved a great deal of chicken fat drainage. And even though audiences' flights from the lipovax spots themselves were absolutely gutting ratings for the other ads and the shows around them, network execs' sweaty sleep infected with vivid REM visions of flaccid, atrophied thumbs coming twitchily to life over remote zap and surf controls. Even though the spots were again fatally potent, the lipovax string's revenues were so obscenely enhanced by the ads that Lipovac Unlimited could soon afford to pay obscene sums for 30-second network spots, truly obscene sums the besieged four now needed in the very worst way. And so the Lipovac ads ran and ran, and much currency changed hands, and overall network ratings began to slump as if punctured with something blunt. From a historical perspective, it's easy to accuse the network corporations of being greedy and short-sighted with regard to explicit liposuction. But Hal argued, with the compassion Mr. Ogilvy found surprising in a seventh grader, that it's probably hard to be restrained and far-sighted when you're fighting against a malignant, invasive, V&V-backed cable cabal for your very fiscal life, day to day. In hindsight, though, the Big Four's spinal camel straw had to have been V&V's trio of deep-focus black-and-white spots for a tiny Wisconsin cooperative firm that sold tongue scrapers by prepaid mail. These ads just clearly crossed some kind of psycho-aesthetic line, regardless of the fact that they single-handedly created a national tongue scraper industry and put Fond du Lac's No Coat Inc. on the Fortune 500.
163.
Stylistically reminiscent of those murderous mouthwash, deodorant, and dandruff shampoo scenarios that had an anti-hero's chance encounter with a gorgeous desire object ending in repulsion and shame because of an easily correctable hygiene deficiency, the no-coat spot's chilling emotional force could be located in the exaggerated hideousness of the near geologic layer of gray-white material coating the tongue of the otherwise handsome pedestrian who accepts a gorgeous meter maid's coquettish invitation to have a bit of a lick of the ice cream cone she's just bought from an avuncular sidewalk vendor. The lingering close-up on an extended tongue that must be seen to be believed, coat-wise. The slow-motion full-frontal shot of the maid's face going slack with disgust as she recoils. The returned cone falling, unfelt from her repulsion-paralyzed fingers. The nightmarish slow-mo with which the mortified pedestrian reels away into street traffic with his whole arm over his mouth. The avuncular vendor's kindly face, now hateful and writhing as he hurls hygienic invectives. These ads shook viewers to the existential core, apparently. It was partly a matter of plain old taste. Ad critics argued that the no-coat spots were equivalent to, like, Preparation H filming a procto exam, or a depend adult undergarment camera panning for floor puddles at a church social. But Hal's paper located the level at which the Big Four's audiences reacted here as way closer to the soul than mere tastelessness can get. V&V's no-coat campaign was a case study in the eschatology of emotional appeals. It's Howard, a kind of Uber ad casting a shaggy shadow back across a whole century of broadcast persuasion. It did what all ads were supposed to do, create an anxiety relievable by purchase. It just did it way more well than wisely, given the vulnerable psyche of an increasingly hygiene-conscious USA in those times. The no-coat campaign had three major consequences. The first was that horrible year Hal vaguely recalls when a nation became obsessed with the state of its tongue, when people would no sooner leave home without a tongue scraper and an emergency backup tongue scraper than they'd fail to wash and brush and spray. The year when the sink and mirror areas of public restrooms were such grim places to be. The no-coat co-op folks traded in their bagosh overalls, and hand-woven ponchos, for Armani and Dior, then quickly disintegrated into various eight-figure litigations. But by this time, everybody from Procter & Gamble to Tom's of Maine had its own brands scraper out, some of them with Baroque and potentially hazardous electronic extras. The second consequence was that the big four broadcast networks finally just plain fell off the shelf, fiscally speaking, riding a crest of public disaffection not seen since the days Jif commercials had strangers shoving their shiny noses in your open jar. The Malone, Turner, and shadowy Albertan-led cable cabal got sponsors whose ads had been running as distant as 7 or 8 spots on either side of the no-coat gaggers to jump ship to AC/DC. U.S. Broadcast TV's True Angels of Death, Malone and Turner then immediately parlayed this fresh injection of sponsorial capital into unrefusable bids for the rights to the NCAA Final Four, the MLB World Series, Wimbledon, and the Pro Bowlers Tour, at which point the Big Four suffered further defections from Schick and Gillette on one side, and Miller and Budd on the other. Fox filed for Chapter 11 protection Monday after AC/DC's coup announcements, and the Dow turned grisly indeed on GE, Paramount, Disney, etc. Within days, 3 out of the Big Four networks had ceased broadcasting operations, and ABC had to fall back on old Happy Days marathons of such relentless duration that bomb threats began to be received both by the network and by poor old Henry Winkler, now hairless and sugar-addicted in La Honda, California, and seriously considering giving that lurid-looking but hope-provoking Lipovac procedure a try. But the ironic third consequence was that almost all the large, slick advertising agencies with substantial network billings, among these the Icarian Viney and Veals, went down too in the Big Four's maelstrom, taking with them countless production companies, graphic artists, account execs, computer enhancement technicians, ruddy-tongued product spokespersons, horn-rimmed demographers, etc. The millions of citizens in areas for one reason or another not cable available ran their VCRs into meltdown, got homicidally tired of Happy Days, and then began to find themselves with vast, maddening blocks of utterly choiceless and unentertaining time. And domestic crime rates, as well as out-and-out suicides, topped out at figures that cast a serious pall over the penultimate year of the millennium. But these consequences own consequence, with all the Yankee ingenious irony that attends true resurrections, comes when the now-combined Big Four, muted and unseen, now, but with its remaining creditor-proof assets now supporting only those rapaciously clever executive minds that can survive the cuts down to a skeleton of a skeleton staff, rises from the dust heap and has a collective last hurrah, ironically, deploying V&V's old pro-choice slash anti-passivity appeal to obliterate the AC/DC that had just months before obliterated the Big Four, bringing TCI's Malone down on a golden bell-shaped chute and sending TBS's Turner into self-imposed nautical exile. Because, enter one Noreen Lace Forche, the USC-educated video rental mogulette who, in the BS 90s, had taken Phoenix's intermission video chain from the middle of the Sunbelt pack to a national distribution second only to Blockbuster Entertainment in gross receipts. The woman called by Microsoft's Gates the killer app queen and by Blockbuster's Hozenga the only woman I personally fear. Convincing the rapacious skeletal remains of the Big Four to consolidate its combined production, distribution, and capital resources behind a front company she'd had incorporated and idling ever since she'd first foreseen broadcast apocalypse in the Nunhagen ad's psycho-fiscal fallout. The front, an obscure-sounding concern called Interlace Tel Entertainment. Lace Forche then went and persuaded ad maestro P. Tom Veals, at that time mourning his remorse-tortured partner's half-gainer off the Tobin Bridge by drinking himself toward pancreatitis in a Beacon Hill brownstone, to regather himself and orchestrate a profound national dissatisfaction with the passivity involved even in DSS-based cable watching. What matter whether your choices are 4, or 104, or 504, Veal's campaign argued. Because here you were. Assuming, of course, you were even cable-ready or dish-equipped and able to afford monthly fees that applied no matter what you chose each month, here you were, sitting here, accepting only what was pumped by distant AC/DC fiat into your entertainment ken. Here you were, consoling yourself about your dependence and passivity with rapid-fire zapping and surfing that were starting to be suspected to cause certain rather nasty types of epilepsy over the longish term. The cable cabal's promise of empowerment, the campaign argued, was still just the invitation to choose which of 504 visual spoon feedings you'd sit there and open wide for.
164.
And so, but what if, their campaign's appeal basically ran, what if, instead of sitting still for choosing the least of 504 infantile evils, the Vox and Digitus Populi could choose to make its home entertainment literally and essentially adult? That is, what if, according to Interlace, what if a viewer could, more or less, 100% choose what's on at any given time? Choose and rent, over PC and modem and fiber optic line, from tens of thousands of second-run films, documentaries, the occasional sport, old beloved non-Happy Days programs, wholly new programs, cultural stuff, and the rest, all prepared by the time-tested, newly lean Big Four's mammoth vaults and production facilities and packaged and disseminated by Interlace Tel Ent, in convenient fiber-optic pulses that fit directly on the new palm-size 4.8-megabyte PC diskettes Interlace was marketing as cartridges. Viewable right there on your trusty PC's high-resolution monitor. Or, if you preferred and so chose, jackable into a good old pre-millennial widescreen TV with at most a coaxial or two. Self-selected programming, chargeable on any major card or on a special low finance charge Interlace account, available to any of the 76% of U.S. households possessed of PC, phone line, and verifiable credit? What if, Veal's spokeswoman ruminated aloud, what if the viewer could become his/her own programming director? What if she/he could define the very entertainment happiness it was her/his right to pursue? The rest, for Hal, is recent history. By the time not only second-run Hollywood releases, but a good many first-run films, plus new sitcoms and crime dramas and near-live sports, plus now also big-name anchor nightly newscasts, weather, art, health, and financial analysis cartridges were available and pulsing nicely onto cartridges everywhere, the ranks of AC/DC's own solvent program pumpers had been winnowed back to the old movie and afternoon baseball major metro regional systems of more like the BS-80s. Passive pickings were slim now. American mass entertainment became inherently proactive, consumer-driven. And because advertisements were now out of the televisual question, any halfway sensitive power PC's CPU could edit out anything shrill or ungratifying in the post-receipt review function of an entertainment diskette, cartridge production, meaning by now both the satellitic spontaneous dissemination of viewer-selected menu programming and the factory recording of programming on packaged 9.6-megabyte diskettes, available cheap and playable on any CD-ROM-equipped system. Yes, cartridge production, though tentacularly controlled by an Interlace that had patented the digital transmission process for moving images and held more stock than any one of the five baby bells involved in the Internet fiber optic transmission grid, bought for 17 cents on the dollar from GTE, after Sprint went belly up trying to launch a primitive, naked, early, mask and tableau-less form of videophony, became almost Hobbesianly free market. No more network reluctance to make a program too entertaining for fear its commercials would pale in comparison. The more pleasing a given cartridge was, the more orders there were for it from viewers. And the more orders for a given cartridge, the more Interlace kicked back to whatever production facility they'd acquired it from. Simple. Personal pleasure and gross revenue looked at last to lie along the same demand curve, at least as far as home entertainment went. And as Interlace's eventual outright purchase of the network's production talent and facilities, of two major home computer conglomerates, of the cutting-edge Frox 2100 CD-ROM licenses, of Apps, Inc., of RCA's DSS orbiters and hardware patents, and of the digital-compatible patents, to the still-needing-to-come-down-in-price-a-little technology of HDTV's visually enhanced color monitor with microprocessed circuitry and 2-to-the-10th area more lines of optical resolution. As these acquisitions allowed Noreen Lace Forche's cartridge dissemination network to achieve vertical integration and economies of scale, viewers, pulse reception, and cartridge fees went down markedly.
165.
And then, the further increased revenues from consequent increases in order and rental volume were plowed presciently back into more fiber optic intergrid cable laying, into outright purchase of 3 of the 5 Baby Bells Internet had started with, into extremely attractive rebate offers on special new Interlace-designed RISC-grade high-def screen PCs with mimetic resolution cartridge view motherboards.
166.
Recognizably renamed by Veals' boys in recognition, teleputers, or TPs, into fiber-only modems, and of course, into extremely high-quality entertainments that viewers would freely desire to choose even more.
167.
But there were, could be, no ads of any kind in the Interlace pulses or ROM cartridges, was the point Hal's presentation kept struggling to return to. And so then, besides, for example, a Turner who kept litigating bitterly via shortwave radio from his equatorial yacht, the true loser in the shift from cable to Interlace grid was an American advertising industry already reeling from the death of broadcast's Big Four. No significant market seemed in any hurry to open up and compensate for the capping of TV's old gusher. Agencies, reduced to skeletal cells of their best and most rapacious creative minds, cast wildly about for new pulses to finger and niches to fill. Billboards sprouted with near mycological fury alongside even rural two-laners. No bus, train, trolley, or hack went unfestooned with high-gloss ads. Commercial airliners began for a while to trail those terse, translucent ad banners, usually reserved for like Piper Cubs over football games and July beaches. Magazines, already endangered by HD video equivalents, got so full of those infuriating little Fallout card ads that fourth-class postal rates ballooned, making the email of their video equivalents that much more attractive, in another vicious cycle. Chicago's once vaunted Sickingen, Smith, and Lundine went so far as to get Ford to start painting little domestic product come-ons on their new line's side panels, an idea that fizzled as U.S. customers in Nike t-shirts and Marlboro caps perversely refused to invest in cars that sold out. In contrast to just about the whole rest of the industry, a certain, partnerless Metro Boston ad agency was doing so well that it was more out of ennui and a sense of unlikely challenge that Tom Veals consented to manage PR for the fringe candidacy of a former crooner and schmaltz mogul who went around swinging a mic and ranting about literally clean streets and creatively refocused blame and rocketing people's waste into the forgiving chill of infinite space.
168.
The 30th of April to the 1st of May, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. Marat did not quite sleep. They had remained on the shelf for some hours. He thought it a bit of much that Steeply refused even for a brief time to sit down upon the ground. If his persona's skirt rode up above his weapon, what was the difference? Were grotesque and humiliating undergarments also involved? Marat's wife had been in an irreversible coma for 14 months. Marat was able to refresh himself without quite sleeping. It was not a state of fugue or neural relaxation, but a type of detachment. He had learned this in the months after losing his legs to a USA train. Part of Marat floated off and hovered somewhere just above him, crossing its legs, nibbling at his consciousness as does a spectator at popcorn. At some times on the outcropping, Steeply went farther than crossing his arms, almost embracing himself, chilled, but unwilling to comment on the chill. Marat noted that the gesture of self-embrace appeared convincingly feminine and unconscious. Steeply's preparations for his returning field assignment had been disciplined and effective. The feature of complete unswallowability about Monsieur Steeply, as a USA female journalist, even a massive and unfortunate-looking USA female journalist, was his feet. These were broad and yellow-nailed, hairy and trollesque, the ugliest feet Marat had observed anywhere south of 60 degrees north, and the ugliest, supposedly, female feet of his experience. Both men were strangely reluctant somehow to broach the subject of plans for getting down off the shelf in the utter dark. Steeply didn't even waste time wondering how Marat could have gotten up or down there in the first place, short of some sort of helicopter drop, which capricious winds and the proximity of the mountainside made unlikely. The dogma around unspecified services was that if Les Assassins de Fauteuil Roulant had one Achilles' heel, it was their penchant for showing off, making a spectacle of denying any kind of physical limitation, etc. Steeply had field interfaced with Rémy Marat once on a rickety-feeling Louisiana oil platform 50-plus clicks out of Kalu Bay, covered the whole time by armed Cajun sympathizers. Marat always disguised the boggling size of his arms under a long-sleeved windbreaker. His eyes were half-closed whenever Steeply turned to look. If he, Marat, were a cat, he would be purring. One hand stayed below the blanket at all times, Steeply noted. Steeply himself had a small and unregistered Taurus PT-9 taped to his shaved inner thigh, which was the main reason he was reluctant to sit down on the outcropping stone. The weapon was unsafetied. In the faint loom and starlight, Marat found the four-limbed American's high-heeled feet compellingly grotesque, like loaves of soft, processed USA bread being slowly squeezed and mangled by the footwear's straps. The meaty compression of the toes at the shoe's open tips, the leather faintly creaking as he bobbed up and down, hugging himself chillily in the sleeveless summer dress, his fleshy bare arms webbed redly with mottle in the chill, one arm luridly scratched. The received wisdom among Quebecois anti-ONAN cells was that there was something latent and sadistic in the Bureau des Services Sans Spécificité's assignments of fictional personae for its field operatives, casting men as women, women as longshoremen or orthodox rabbinicals, heterosexual men as homosexual men, Caucasians as Negroes or caricaturesque Haitians and Dominicans, healthy males as degenerative nerve disease sufferers, healthy women operatives as hydrocephalic boys or epileptic public relations executives. Non-deformed USOUS personnel made not only to pretend but sometimes to actually suffer actual deformity, all for the realism of their field personae. Steeply, silent, rose and fell absently on the toes of these feet. The feet were also visibly unused to high USA women's heels, for they were mangled-looking, deprived of flowing blood, and abundantly blistered. And the smallest toes' nails were blackening and preparing, Marat noted, in the future, to fall off. But Marat knew also that something within the real Monsieur Hugh Steeply did need the humiliations of his absurd field personae. That the more grotesque or unconvincing he seemed likely to be as a disguised persona, the more nourished and actualized his deep parts felt in the course of preparation for the humiliating attempt to portray. He, Steeply, used the mortification he felt as a huge woman, or pale Negro, a palsied twit of a degenerative musician, as fuel for the assignment's performance. Steeply welcomed the subsumption of his dignity and self in the very role that offended his dignity of self. The psychomechanics became too confusing for Marat, who had not the capacity for abstractions of his AFR superiors, Fortier and Bruyim. But he knew this was why Steeply was one of Service Saint-Spécifité's finest field operatives, once spending the better part of a year in magenta robes, sleeping 3 hours nightly, and allowing his large head to be shaved and teeth removed, shaking a tambourine in airports and selling plastic flowers on median strips, to infiltrate a cult-fronted 3-amino-8 hydroxytetralene import ring in the USA city Seattle.
169.
Steeply said, "Because this is the thing about the AFR that really gives them the fantods, if you're talking about fear and want to fear."
He spoke either quietly or not, that Marat could determine. The empty expanse they both faced, off the shelf, sucked all resonance, causing every sound to sound self-enclosed, and every utterance to seem flatly soft and somehow over-intimate, almost post-coital. The sounds of things said beneath blankets, winter beating at the log walls. Steeply himself appeared frightened, perhaps, or confused. He continued,
"This disinterest by you guys, it seems, in anything but the harm itself, just getting the entertainment out there to hurt us."
"The naked aggression by us?"
Muscles beneath the nylons of the calves bulged and receded as Steeply bobbed.
"The boys in behavioral science say they can't see any sort of positive political goal the AFR even wants. Anything Duplessis was having your Fortier work toward."
"The Juras de Fantades are meaning fear, confusion, standing hair."
"The FLQ and the Montcalmists, shit. Even the most whacked out of Albertans ultra-rightists."
Monsieur Duplessis had once studied beneath radical Edmonton Jesuits, Marat reflected.
"Them we can begin to understand as political bodies. Them we can more or less get a feel for dealing with."
"Their aggression is clothed in agenda. The Bureau of You proceeds."
Steeply's was a thinking face now, in apparent puzzlement.
"They at least have aims, real desires."
"For themselves?"
Steeply appeared convincingly to ruminate.
"It's like there's a context for the whole game, then, with them. We know where we stand differs from where they stand. There's a sort of playing field of context."
Causing the chair to squeak, Marat again rotated two fingers of a hand in the air, which for Quebecers signifies impatience.
"Rules of play, rules of engagement."
The other hand was with the Sterling UL machine pistol beneath the blanket.
"Even historically, the 60s bomb tossers, the Spic separatists, the ragheads."
"Very charming. These are attractive terms."
"Ragheads, Colombians, Brazilians. They had positive objectives."
"Desires for self which you could understand."
"Even if the objectives were nothing more than things we could file, pinned to the board under stated objectives. The pathetic Spics, they wanted certain things. There was a context, a compass for maneuvers against them."
"Your guardians of national security could understand these positive desires of self-interest. Look at them and relate, as one says at least, knowing where you stand on the field of play."
Steeply slowly nodded, as if to only himself.
"There wasn't just pure malice. There was never the sense that here were some people who had just all of a sudden let the air out of your tires for no reason."
"You allege we disperse our resources deflecting automobile tires?"
"A figure of speech. Or, for example, a serial killer, a sadist, somebody who wants you down just for the deviant sake of wanting you down. A deviant."
Far south, a blinking system of tricolored lights described a spiral over the airport's tower's pulsing tip. This was a landing aircraft. Steeply lit another cigarette off the butt of his previous and then tossed the butt, peering over the shelf's edge to watch its spiraled fall. Marat was looking up and right. Steeply said,
"Because politics are one thing. Even way out far in the distance fringe politics are one thing. Your 48 doesn't seem to care much about reconfiguration, territory, redemisement, cartography, tariffs, Finlandization, ONA-anite Anschluss, or toxic waste displacement.
Experialism,
Steeply said, or so-called experialism. Even separatism. None of the other cells' agendas seem to drive you people. Most of the office sees it as just sheer malice with you. No agenda or story.
And for you, there is something appalling.
Steeply pursed his lips as if trying to blow something off them.
But when there are delineatable strategic political goals and objectives, when there's some set of ends we can make sense of the malice with, then it's just business.
Nothing of persons.
Marat was looking up. Some of the stars seemed to flutter, others to burn with more steadiness.
We know which end is up when it's business. We've got a field and a compass.
He regarded Marat directly in a way that was not accusing.
This seems personal, he said.
Marat could not think of descriptions for the way Steeply regarded him. Neither was it sad, nor inquisitive, nor quite ruminative. There were small flickers and shadows of movements around the flickers of the celebratory fire down far away on the floor of the desert. Marat could not determine whether Steeply was truly revealing emotions about himself. The flickers continually went out. Small shreds of young laughter drifted up to them in the vacuous silence. There were also sometimes rustles in the hillside's scrub of gravel or small living nightly things. Or whether perhaps Steeply was trying to give him something, let him know something, and determine whether it went back to Monsieur Fortier. Marat's arrangement with the Office of Unspecified Services seemed most often to consist in submitting himself to numerous tests and games of truth and betrayal. He felt often with USOUS, like a caged rodent, being regarded blandly by bland men in white coats.
Marat shrugged. USA has previously been hated, richly so. Shining Path and your Maxwell-ass company, the trans-Latin cocaine cartels, and the poor late Monsieur Kemp with his exploding home. Did not both Iraq and Iran call USA the very large Satan? As you hatefully say, they have heads of rags?
Steeply exhumed smoke quickly to reply.
Yes, but there were still contexts and ends. Revenue, religion, spheres of influence, Israel, petroleum, neo-Marxism, post-Cold War power jockeying. There was always a third thing.
Some desire.
Some piece of business. Some third thing between them and us. It wasn't just us. It was something they wanted from us, or wanted us out of.
Steeply seemed earnestly to say it.
The third thing, the goal or desire, it mediated the ill will, abstracted it somehow.
For this is how one who is sane proceeds,
Marat said, paying great concentration to aligning the blanket's hems against his chest and wheels.
Some desire of self, and efforts expending to meet that desire.
Not just wanting negatives, Steeply said, shaking the lurid head. Not just wanting some other's harm for no purpose.
Marat again found himself pretending to sniff with the congestion.
And their USA purpose? Desires?
This he asked quietly. Its sound was strange against stone. Steeply was pinching yet a next particle of tobacco from his lipstick. He said,
This you can't generalize on with most of us, since our whole system is founded on your individual's freedom to pursue his own individual desires.
His mascara had now cooled in the formations of its past running. Marat kept silent and fussed with the blanket as Steeply sometimes regarded him. A whole minute passed this way. Finally, Steeply said,
For me personally, as an American, Ramey, if you're really serious, I think it's probably your standard old basic American dreams and ideals. Freedom from tyranny, from excessive want, fear, censorship of speech and thought.
He was looking with seriousness, even in this wig.
The old ones, tested by time. Relative plenty, meaningful work, adequate leisure time. The ones you might call corny.
His smiling revealed to Marat lipstick upon one incisor.
We want choice, a sense of efficaciousness in choice. To be loved by someone, to freely love who you happen to love, to be loved irregardless of whether you can tell them classified stuff about your job, to have them just trust you and trust that you know what you're doing, to feel valued, not to be agendalessly despised, to have good neighborly relations, cheap and abundant energy, pride in your work and family and home. The lipstick had been smeared onto the tooth when the finger had removed the grain of tobacco. He was faisait monter la pression.
170.
The little things. Access to transport, good digestion, work-saving appliances, a wife who doesn't mistake your job's requirements for your own fetishes, reliable waste removal and disposal, sunsets over the Pacific, shoes that don't cut off circulation, frozen yogurt, a tall lemonade on a squeak-free porch swing. Marat's face, it showed nothing.
The loyalty of a domestic pet.
Steeply pointed the cigarette. There you go, friend.
High quality entertainment. I value for the dollar of leisure and spectation.
Steeply laughed agreeably, exhaling a shaped sausage of smoke. In response to this, Marat smiled. There was some silence for thinking until Marat finally said, looking up and off to think,
This Eurasat type of person and desires appears to me like almost the classic, utilitaire?
A French appliance?
Comment dit, Marat said. Utilitarian. Maximum pleasure. Minimize displeasure. Result? What is good? This is the USA of you.
Steeply pronounced the USA English word for Marat then. Then a sustained pause. Steeply rose and fell upon his toes. A bonfire of young persons was burning some kilometers down away on the desert floor, the flames burning in a seeming ring instead of a sphere.
Marat said, But yes, but precisely whose pleasure and whose pain? In this personality type's equation of what is good.
When Steeply removed a particle of the cigarette from the lip, he would then roll it absently between his first finger and thumb. This did not appear womanly. Come again?
Marat scratched inside the windbreaker. I am wondering, me, on the equations of this USA type. The best good is each individual USA person's maximum pleasure, or it is the maximum pleasure for all the people?
Steeply nodded in a way that indicated willing patience for someone whose wits were not too speedy. But there you go. But this question itself shows how our different types of national character part ways from each other, Raimi. The American genius, our good fortune, is that someplace along the line back there in American history, them realizing that each American seeking to pursue his maximum good results together in maximizing everyone's good.
Ah.
We learned this as early as grade school, as kids.
I am seeing.
This is what lets us steer free of oppression and tyranny. Even your Greekly democratic, howling mob-type tyranny. The United States, a community of sacred individuals, which reveres the sacredness of the individual choice. The individual's right to pursue his own vision of the best ratio of pleasure to pain. Utterly sacrosanct. Defended with teeth and bared claws all through our history.
Bien sûr.
Steeply, for the first time, seemed to be feeling with his hand his wig's disorder. He was attempting to straightly reposition it without removing the wig. Marat tried not to envision what his BSS had done to the natural brown male hair of Steeply to accommodate the complex wig. Steeply said, It might be hard for you to quite understand what's so precious about this for us. From across this chasm of different values that separates our peoples. Marat flexed his hand.
Perhaps because it is so general and abstracted. In practice, however, you may force me to understand.
We don't force. It's exactly about not forcing our history's genius. You are entitled to your values of maximum pleasure, so long as you don't fuck with mine. Are you seeing?
Perhaps help me see by practical evidence. An instance. Suppose you are able at one moment to increase your own pleasure, but the cost of this is the displeasuring pain of another. Another sacred individual's displeasing pain.
Steeply said, Well, now this is precisely what gives us the fantods about the AFR. Why it's so important, I think, to remember how we come from different cultures and value systems, Raimi. Because in our U.S. value system, anybody who derives an increase in pleasure from somebody else's pain is a deviant, a sadistic sicko, and is thereby excluded from the community of everybody's right to pursue their own best pleasure-to-pain ratio. Sickos deserve compassion and the best treatment feasible, but they're not part of the big picture.
Marat willed himself not to rise on his stumps again.
No, but not another's pain as a pleasurable end in itself. I did not mean where my pleasure is your pain. How to say better? Imagine there arises a situation in which your deprivation or pain is merely the consequence, the price, of my own pleasure.
You mean you're talking a tough choices, limited resources type situation?
But in the simplest of examples, the most childlike case.
Marat's eyes momentarily gleamed with enthusiasm.
Suppose that you and I, we both wish to enjoy a hot bowl of the Abiton Soupopois.
Steeply said, You mean?
But yes, French-Canadian type pea soup. Produit du Montréal. Savour maison. Prêt à servir.
171.
What is it with you people and this stuff?
In this case, imagining both you and I are in the worst way craving for Abiton soup. But there is one can only, of the small and well-known single-serving size.
An American invention, by the way, the 3S, let's insert.
The part of Marat's mind that hovered above and watched coldly, it could not know whether Steeply was being deliberately, parodically dense and annoying to arouse Marat to some revealing passion. Marat made his rotary gesture of impatience slowly.
But, okay, he said neutrally. It is simple here. We both want the soup. Sell me my pleasure from eating the Abiton Soupopois as the price of your pain at not eating soup when you badly crave it.
Marat was patting his pockets for something.
And the reverse, if you are who eats the serving. But the US had genius for each persuivre Lebonair, then, who can decide who may receive the soup?
172.
Steeply stood with weight on one leg.
Example's a bit oversimplified. We'd bid on the soup, maybe. We negotiate. Maybe we divide the soup.
No, for the ingenious single-serving size of serving is notoriously for only one. And we are both large and vigorous USA individuals who have spent the afternoon watching huge men in pads and helmets hurl themselves at one another in the high definition of interlace. And we are both ravenous for the satiation of a complete hot bowl's serving. Half the bowl would only torment this craving I have.
The fast shadow of pain across the face of Steeply showed Marat's choice of example was witty. The divorced USA man has much experience with the small size of single-serving products.
Marat said, Okay, yes, why should I, as the sacred individual, give you half of my soup? My own pleasure over torment is what is good, for I am a loyal USA, a genius of this individual desire.
The bonfire slowly was filling out. Another cross of colored light circled the airport area of Tucson. Steeply's movements of smoothing the wig and twisting fingers through the snarls of hair became perhaps more abrupt and frustrated.
Steeply said, Well, whose soup is it legally? Who actually bought the soup?
Marat shrugged.
Not relevant for my question. Suppose a third party, now unfortunately deceased. He appears at our flat with a can of soupepois to eat while watching recorded USA Sporting, and suddenly is scratching his heart and falls to the carpeting deceased, holding the soup we are now both so wishing.
Then we bid on the soup. Whoever's got the most desire for the soup, and is willing to fork over the higher price, buys out the other's half. Then the other just rolls on down to Safeway, and buys himself some more soup. Whoever's willing to put his money where his hunger is gets the dead guy's soup.
Marat shook his head without any heat.
The Safeway store and bidding These are also not relevant to my question, I hope, the example of pea soup to raise, which perhaps this is a dull-witted question.
Steeply was at the wig with both hands for repair. Former perspiration had mashed its form inward on one side, as well as small clots and small burrs, from the falls of his descent to the outcropping. Presumably there was no comb or brushes in his small evening's wear purse. The rear of his dress was dirty. The straps of his prosthesis brassiere dug cruelly into the meat of his back and shoulders. Again there was for Marat the picture of something soft being slowly throttled. Steeply was responding,
"No, I know what you want to raise, all right. You want to talk politics. Scarcity, and allocating, and tough choices, all right? Politics we can understand, all right. Politics we can discuss. I bet I know where you want to raise the question of what prevents 310 million individual American happiness pursuers from all going around bonking each other over the head and taking each other's soup. A state of nature, my own pleasure, and to hell with all the rest."
Marat had his handkerchief out.
"What does this wish to mean, this bonking?"
"Because this simplistic example shows just how far apart across the chasm our people's values are, friend," Steeply was saying this. "Because a certain basic amount of respect for the wishes of other people is required, is in my interest, in order to preserve a community where my own wishes and interests are respected, okay? My total and overall happiness is maximized by respecting your individual sanctity and not simply kicking you in the knee and running off with the soup." Steeply watched Marat blow one nostril into the handkerchief. Marat was one of the rare types who did not examine the hanky after he blew. Steeply said,
But then I can anticipate somebody on your side of the chasm retorting with something like, quote, "Yes, my very good ami, but what if your rival for the pleasurable soup is some individual outside your community, for example?" You'll say, "Let's just make the example that it's a hapless Canadien, foreign, en outre.
Separated from me by a chasm of history and language and value and deep respect for individual freedom. Then in this wholly random instance, there would be no community-minded constraints on my natural impulse to bonk your head and commandeer the desired soup, since the poor Canadian is outside the equation of poursuivre labeneur of each individual, since he is not a part of the community whose environment of mutual respect I depend on for pursuing my interest of maximal pleasure to pain." Marat, during this time, was smiling up and to the left, north, rolling his head like a blind person. His favorite personal place of off-duty in the USA city Boston was in the public garden of summer, a broad and treeless declivity leading down to the Mer de Canard, the duck pond, a grassy wedge facing south and west, so that the grass of the slope turns pale green and then gold as the sun circles over the head, the pond's water cool and muddy green, and overhung with impressionist willows. Persons beneath the willows, also pigeons, and ducks with tight emerald heads gliding in circles, their eyes round stones, moving as if without effort, gliding upon the water as if legless below. Like film's idols in cities the moment before the nuclear blast, in old films of USA death and horror. He was missing this time in USA Boston, Massachusetts, of refilling the pond for the duck's return, the willows greening, the wine light of a northern sunset curving gently in to land without explosion. Children flew taut kites, and adults lay supine on the slope absorbing the suntan, eyes closed as if in concentration. He was giving out a small and desolate smile, as of fatigue. His wrist's watch was unilluminated. Steeply threw a butt without turning away from Marat to watch it fall.
"And you'll accuse me of, you'll say, I won't only poke him in the eye and commandeer the whole serving of soup for myself," Steeply said, "but well, after eating it, I'll give him the dirty bowl and spoon and maybe even the no-deposit habitant can to have to deal with. Saddle him with my greed's waste, all under some sham arrangement of, quote, interdependence that's really just a crude nationalist scheme to indulge my own U.S. individual pleasure lust, without the complications or annoyance of considering some neighbor's own desires and interests."
Marat said, "You will notice that I do not with sarcasm say, 'And here we go, aft together once more.' which you enjoy saying.
Steeply's use of the body to shelter the lighting match for his smoking was not feminine either. His parody of Marat's accent sounded guttural and USA Cajun with a cigarette in the mouth. He looked up past the flame.
But no, am I off base?
Marat had an almost Buddhist way of studying the blanket on his lap. For some seconds he behaved as if almost asleep, nodding very smallly with the rise and fall of his lungs. The ponderous rectangles of moving light within Tucson's nightly spread were barges of land, ministering to nests of dumpsters in the deep part of night. Part of Marat always felt almost a desire to shoot persons who anticipated his responses and inserted words and said they were from Marat, not letting him speak. Marat suspected Steeply of knowing this, sensing this in Marat. All two of Marat's older brothers from childhood had engaged in this, arguing every side and silencing Raimi by inserting his words. Both had kissed trains head-on before reaching marriageable age.
173.
Marat had been part of the audience for the death of the better one. Some of the barges of land's waste would be vectored into the Sonora region of Mexico, but much would be shipped north for displacement launch into the convexity. Steeply was regarding him.
No, Raimi? Am I off base in terms of what you'd say?
The smile around Marat's mouth cost him all his training in restraint.
The cans containing habitants, c'est bordelé, vouillez recycler sous contenant. You are not first, maybe, but I think I am asking less for nations arguing and more for the example of you and me only. We two, if we pretend we are both of your USA type, each separate, both sacred, both desiring a superpoids. I am asking how is community and your respect part of my happiness in this moment, with the soup, if I am a USA person.
Steeply worked a finger under one strap of the brassiere to relieve the throttling pressure.
I don't get you.
Well, we both crave badly the entire recyclable single-serving can of this habitant.
Marat sniffed.
In my mind, I know it is true that I must not simply make a bonking of your head and take away the soup, because my overall happiness of pleasure, of the long term, needs a community of, rien de bonk.
174.
But this is long term, Steeply. This is down the road of my happiness, this respecting of you. How do I calculate this distant road of long term into my action of this moment, now, with our dead comrade clutching the soup, and both of us with spittle on our chins as we regard the soup? My question is trying to say, if the most pleasure right now, en ce moment, is in the oil serving of habitants, how is myself able to put aside this moment's pleasure to make bonk on you and take the soup? How am I able to think past this soup to the future of my soup down the road?
In other words, delayed gratification.
Good. This is well. Delayed gratification. How is my USA type able, in my mind, to calculate my long-term overall pleasure, then decide to sacrifice this intense sub-craving of this moment to the long-term and overall?
Steeply sent out two hard tusks of smoke from the nostrils of his nose. His expression was one of patience together with polite impatience.
I think it's called simply being a mature and adult American, instead of a childish and immature American. A term we might use might be enlightened self-interest.
Déclassons.
Steeply, he did not smile back.
Enlightened. For example, your example from before. The little kid who'll eat candy all day because it's what tastes best at each individual moment.
Even if he knows inside his mind it will hurt his stomach and rot his little fangs.
Teeth, Steeply corrected. But see that here it can't be a fascist matter of screaming at the kid or giving him electric shocks each time he overindulges in candy. You can't induce a moral sensibility the same way you train a rat. The kid has to learn by his own experience how to learn to balance the short and long-term pursuit of what he wants.
He must be fully enlightened to self.
This is the crux of the educational system you find so appalling. Not to teach what to desire,
to teach how to be free, to teach how to make knowledgeable choices about pleasure and delay, and a kid's overall down-the-road maximal interest.